Hey, welcome along to another edition of Mark's Mailbox. Bit of a mopping up operation we do once in a while. These are some questions from Mark Stein Club members submitted when we did one of our live Clubland Q&As around the planet that we didn't get to. So the more interesting ones we put to one side and we use them in Mark's Mailbox. And this one comes from Matt Watson, and he goes, Mark, I was wondering if you're ever going to comment on the recent controversy surrounding Professor Bruce Gilley and his article, The Case for Colonialism. The social justice crowd has been going bonkers over it, and it seems some observation would be apt. This is an essay in favour of qualified support for colonialism as a good thing. And it appeared in the Third World Quarterly, and it was excoriated by Professor Gilley's critics, not particularly because of anything that he'd said that they wanted to point out was factually incorrect. But the article has now been withdrawn from the Third World Quarterly by the publishers, Taylor and Francis. They publish all these scholarly journals, and they issued the following statement. This is a remarkable statement, actually. Following a number of complaints, Taylor and Francis conducted a thorough investigation into the peer review process on this article. By the way, peer review is scholarly talk for total bollocks, as you know, if you were in my shoes and you'd had anything to do with climate science peer review over the years. It's a deeply corrupted process. But anyway, they say, Taylor and Francis continue, while this clearly demonstrated the essay had undergone double-blind peer review, in other words, it's gone through all the proper process, in line with the journal's editorial policy, the journal editor has subsequently received serious and credible threats of personal violence. This is amazing. A guy writes a paper for a scholarly journal, and it's withdrawn because the editor receives threats of personal violence. And because we live in a pansified age, instead of standing up for academic freedom, these guys cave and withdraw the paper because the people who don't like the paper have threatened the physical safety of the editor. Now, on the matter of the case for colonialism, you don't need me to tell you that I'm broadly on Professor Gilley's side, and I was colonialist before colonialism was cool. As I often say, I'm basically a 19th century imperialist, 100 years past my sell-by date. But it so happened that Matt's question came to me on the day that the Cato Institute in the United States and the Fraser Institute in the Dominion of Canada released their rankings of economic freedom in the world. I love this list. So I'm going to do it in Casey Kasem Top 40 style. I'm going to go count it down in reverse order. Hit sound number 10, 10th freest, economically freest country in the world, Estonia. Number 9, Australia. Number 8, Georgia. Number 7, Mauritius. Number 6, the United Kingdom. Number 5, Ireland. Number 4, Switzerland. Number 3, New Zealand. Number 2, Singapore. Number 1, Hong Kong. Now, if you're an American and you're wondering where the United States comes in economic freedom, they're just bubbling under the top 10 at hit sound number 11. If you're Canadian and you're wondering where Canada comes in the rankings of economic freedom, they're also bubbling under the top 10, tied with America at number 11. So, do you notice anything that those countries have in common? The top 12. Hong Kong, Singapore, New Zealand, Switzerland, Ireland, United Kingdom, Mauritius, Georgia, Australia, Estonia, Canada, and the United States. 12 countries. 9 of them are current or former realms of Her Britannic Majesty. In other words, at one time or another, they were either colonized or settled by Mother England. And of those 12 economically freest countries in the world, 9 derive from England. That's the case for colonialism. That's the case for British colonialism. The dominant regional power in almost any corner of the earth. What do they have in common? South Africa, India, Australia. What do they have in common? The hyperpower of the age, the United States. So I think the case for colonialism is pretty obvious. Not generally speaking, I regard... Look, I'll say this because nobody else will. I'm not saying the British Empire is the best and the rest of you guys suck, but I'm actually tiptoeing up to the brink of saying it because somebody has to say it. Because you're not actually doing any favours to people when you encourage newly independent countries to trash their inheritance. Because you don't even actually have to compare people on other side of, on different sides of the globe. The interesting thing about this list is it includes, obviously, nations that were settled by England, in a certain sense, Australia. But it also includes places on disparate parts of the earth. It includes Mauritius off the coast of Africa and the Indian Ocean. It includes Singapore in Asia. But the fact of the matter is that a good, reliable indicator of how well you do is how well you preserve that colonial inheritance. You don't have to compare apples and oranges. If you just go to the Indian subcontinent and you look at India, the world's largest democracy, it has mainly kept its Westminster institutions. It has mainly kept its inheritance. If you look next door at Pakistan, also carved out of the British Raj in India, they have instead gone for Sharia, and they're becoming and they've gone backwards as India has gone forwards. That's why when you call tech support at 3 a.m. From New Jersey or Florida, you're speaking to Rajiv or Suresh in Bangalore rather than some guy in Islamabad or Karachi. And that's not to say that the English are the most agreeable people in the world. I've just, in fact, the lady who did my makeup has just been a very nice Englishman. I said, you've got to be very careful about them. They can be charming, superficially charming, but they can be some of the most duplicitous fellows on the planet. You've got to be wary about them. And a lot of people don't like the English. And people chafed under English rule. But even the chippiest nationalists, by which I mean, say, Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore or Nehru in India or De Valera, even close to home in Dublin, knew enough not to get rid of they knew enough that if you enjoyed the benefits of Magna Carta, common law, Shakespeare, you'd have to be pretty stupid to get rid of them. And the guys who did get rid of them, which is mainly a lot of peripheral African basket cases, they did no benefits to their people. So I don't find it difficult to make the case for colonialism as a civilizing force in the world. No institution did more to rid the world of slavery than the Royal Navy. Record is perfect. And in the balance of history, there are always failings. But on the whole, the record of the British Empire in particular is all well and good, and people should recognise that. Anti-colonials, I saw somebody objecting to this thing. They were going on about King Leopold. Belgium had one lousy, stinking colony. I know this. My mum was Belgian. Belgium was a lousy colonial power. That's why they didn't have an empire. That's why King Leopold had the Congo as his, like, personal plaything. And the Belgians were lousy colonialists. And you notice when people run down colonialism, they always eventually come back to King Leopold. That's not the story of colonialism. The story of colonialism is Barbados and Mauritius and Singapore and Malaysia, and India. And I'm with Professor Gilley, and I said earlier that you can, generally speaking, you can tell how well these countries are doing now by how much of their inheritance they kept. The ones that didn't keep their inheritance Places like Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe, with his strange Chinese-made rubber prosthesis, I won't go into any more detail because that's the sort of thing that he's very sensitive if you start mentioning. But if you say anything against Robert Mugabe, such as bringing up his rubber prosthesis in an interesting and unusual place and made by the Chinese, he sends gangs out into the street to beat you up. That's what these guys have done. They've actually embraced the argument of the thug anti-colonialists. They didn't like the case for colonialism, so they threatened the editor of the journal that published it. And that tells you how weak the case for anti-colonialism is. As I said, we're 19th century imperialists here. Holly says, what do you think of the latest monk debate topic? American democracy is in its worst crisis in a generation. And Donald Trump is to blame. Where do they come up with these resolutions? I took part in last year's monk debate. You can find it out there on the internet. It was about the refugee crisis. And Nigel Farage and I had great fun with Louise Arbour, former UN High Commissioner, and Simon Sharma, the BBC historian. You can find that out. It was a fun debate. This year's was American democracy is in its worst crisis in a generation, and Donald Trump is to blame. I actually agree that American democracy is in a pretty bad crisis, but Donald Trump is not to blame for that. That's the reason Donald Trump got elected, is because American institutions ceased to function and seized up and became essentially a closed club that operated in the interests of particular influential groups, and a lot of people felt excluded from it, and they voted for Donald Trump. But you've seen it in the last, insofar as there's a crisis at the moment, it's that the Republican Party did not realize that they had, last November, they'd been handed a great opportunity to actually demonstrate that they were a modernizing, efficient governing party that could accomplish great things. And instead, these a small group of narcissist senators decided that they had no interest in the president's agenda, and they decided to obstruct it. And it's true that the US Constitution differs from a Westminster Constitution or most parliamentary constitutions. Not just in Canada or Oz or whatever, but even by comparison with continental Europe, in that it was designed to be difficult to do things, and that works in a small government culture. But the effect of that, when you have a big government culture, which is what we have now, is that it's still difficult to do things, but what is difficult to do is to actually reverse the ratchet effect of big government, which just keeps growing and growing and growing like that monstrous plant in Little Shop of Horrors. You go to bed for a couple of hours and you wake up in the morning and the big oozing pustules of the big government plant are even worse than they were the previous day. And I think that's... So it's very difficult to do, for example, what Sir Roger Douglas did as finance minister in New Zealand in the 1980s, when they basically privatized a whole bunch of stuff and shrank the size of New Zealand government. It'd be wonderful to do that in the United States, but it's actually difficult to do. And the Senate in particular is a dysfunctional institution. Then you have the crisis of judicial legislating, which is an abomination in and of itself. I mean, I don't really care what a judge thinks in terms of what he thinks a bill should be. I don't want judges of any kind legislating. But it's particularly bad when most judges are, so to speak, social justices. And so you can have a district court judge in Hawaii or wherever who thinks he has the power to essentially remake American foreign policy and strike down Trump's so-called travel ban on six or seven different countries. So I think it's important to bear in mind here, there are systemically dysfunctional institutions in the United States. And Trump is not to blame for that, in part That's why Trump got elected. Kate Smith writes, a specific Harvey Weinstein question, because we all love Harvey Weinstein. He's such a charmer. The ladies adore him. Are corporations such as Miramax or the BBC with Jimmy Savile effectively the same as church institutions found to be complicit in historical sex abuse crimes, in putting the interests and reputation of the organisation ahead of the safety of individuals, including potential future victims? Isn't the hushed payout akin to moving the offending priest to a different parish? This is a very interesting question. I think it's actually worse than that. Because in the Catholic Church, they had problems with priests. And if you look at the Boston Diocese, they moved some of these guys around until I think one guy, they'd moved him all the way through Massachusetts and up through the state of Maine, all the way up to the Maine-New Brunswick border. That was basically as far as they could move that guy, moving him around. Cardinal Law, I think, was the guy's name running that operation. It's actually worse, I would say, at Miramax. Because when you hire those, the Catholic institution bodies that were doing that were actually still doing real jobs. Harvey Weinstein's companies had all kinds of people whose only job was to procure broads for him to hit on. They paid the head of Miramax Italy $400,000 just to find chicks for Harvey to grope. So that's a non-job. And that, by the way, is a personal expense of Harvey's. That's not a legitimate business expense. If you have a $400,000 a year position at Miramax, that guy is supposed to be doing something involving motion pictures. He's not just supposed to be arranging what we might euphemistically call Harvey Weinstein's social life. So that's an issue for Miramax. I don't know where the taxes were so-called, or where the business expense was deducted in that, whether it was deducted in Italy or via the parent company, Disney, in the United States. But that is an issue that some revenue agency in Italy or in the US ought to be looking into. I'll tell you something else too, and this is the corruption. There was a pattern of behavior at the Weinstein Company in Los Angeles where Harvey would meet some young actress. He'd be at a gala, an awards show, or the Cannes Film Festival, the Toronto Film Festival, any film festival. And a couple of months later, he'd call him up. He'd ask him to come to lunch or something. And the pattern of behavior was that a woman would make the call and say, Harvey wants to meet with you in his room or meet alone with you. And the woman who would make the call and set up the appointment would always explain that she was going to be there too. So you thought it was going to be a meeting with multiple people, including the woman who was arranging the appointment. And then the woman who made the appointment always knew that 10 minutes after the meeting started, she said that she suddenly had some other meeting to go to, and she would withdraw and leave Harvey around to drop his pants in front of whatever actress or whoever that he was interested in nailing on then. Now, that's what makes it systemic corruption. And that's what shames and taints the Weinstein Company, and why I believe, I mean, they'll be changing their name. They'll do it quietly. They'll keep this stupid name for another few weeks. But that name isn't going to be on anything in a year's time. You know that. Okay. Oh, Matthew McWilliams also on that. He says, hi, Mark. It's easy for me to write off Harvey Weinstein and those like him as brutes who think it their right to satisfy whatever primal urge they might have at a given moment. What I find more puzzling is the general dismantling of the traditional cultural values related to marriage, gender, citizenship, etc., as well as the general assault on our historical inheritance. I find it hard to believe that anyone in a position of real power actually believes these are good ideas for maintaining an orderly society, yet they continue to promote them. So my question is a simple one, but perhaps difficult to answer. In your view, what is the long game in all this in terms of societal organization? Does a long-term strategy even exist? Do you think anybody promoting these ideas has actually given any thought to where this is supposed to lead, let alone where it might actually lead to? Well, I think it's actually an alliance between two forces. I think when you look at the people on the streets, for example, they're the Antifa people or the Black Lives Matter people or whatever. And I think they generally are interested in just destroying. You turn your back for a minute in Berkeley or in Ferguson, and they're just smashing small businesses, or they're smashing a monument to Christopher Columbus or to Robert E. Lee or whatever. And they just like smashing and destroying. And they are actually just, that is just a general nihilism and destruction. But I think the danger is that the elites make common cause with them. And that's not just the sort of frisson you get if you're producing some dreary awards show on TV and you've got like a dance routine and you think it might be good to have like just a little Black Lives Matter edginess in the dance routine. But just give it a, you know, just make it a little edgy and transgressive. They're just trying to, that's basically anarchism as a fashion statement. But I think it also gets to the heart of an entertainment culture. I mean, if you look at people like Harvey Weinstein, they make a 90-minute, two-hour entertainment, and it makes $1 billion. I mean, that's incredible. That's incredible. And it grew, and just to be clear about this, that's from a form of dramatic storytelling that as recently as 120 years ago, people still had to tour it around, going from town to town, theatre to theatre. So when you were doing your 90-minute, two-hour storytelling, you'd be turning up, getting off the train in some little dumpy provincial town, and you'd be going to backstage to a grubby dressing room, and you'd be putting grease paint on your face, and you'd do your little 90-minute, two-hour storytelling. And then at the end of it, you might go for dinner in the local hotel in that town. And that was two-hour dramatic storytelling 120 years ago. Now it's billion-dollar storytelling across the planet. And it's the most, it's one of the most successful businesses ever devised. And so the people, if you make your living like that, if you're paid $20 million to be in Iron Man 7 or Cardboard Man 12, or actually Harvey Weinstein, he's starring in Pigman. It's coming up, it's the biggest Hollywood blockbuster yet, and you'll love it. I think it becomes very difficult to actually think in rational socioeconomic terms. Now, then you take it to the next level. You look at Facebook. A guy invents a template by which a housewife in Ohio or a guy in the jungle in Papua New Guinea can just upload and share little photographs of what they've been doing. And 95% of it is totally boring and of no interest. It's basically like home movies used to be in the 70s, where the dreaded part of the evening was when your host said, "Hey, do you want to look at these holiday snaps that I took? I was on the beach in Spain for a week and I took some holiday snaps. Would you like to look at my holiday snaps from Spain?" And nobody did. There would be seven people in the room and none of them wanted to see his home movies. And then as this guy Zuckerberg comes along and says, "You can upload all this rubbish that nobody wants to see and it'll become the biggest business on the planet." So he's actually gone one better than the two-hour dramatic storytelling, taking old-time 19th century melodrama and doing it on a big flickering screen. He's actually taken, he doesn't have to create any content. He doesn't even have to hire anybody to create content. He just has to get billions of all 7 billion people on the planet to give them the most, to give him the most boring content in the world for free, and it becomes the biggest business on the planet. Now, once you've done that, why wouldn't you think that you can remake anything? Why would you think citizenship is important? Why would you think, why would it be odd that Facebook now has 57 different genders where before there used to just be two sexes, man and woman? I mean, if you can actually become the biggest company on the planet from getting people to give you the world's most boring content for free, why wouldn't you think you can remake sex and remake citizenship and remake anything you want to? And I think in that sense, they're boundless. The fact that there are no, their boundless ambition derives from the fact that the entertainment industry in that sense is divorced, and media and the internet, social media, all the rest of it, is divorced from standard socioeconomic pressure on a scale that no one has ever yet seen. Let's have one last question. Oh, Lloyd Nixon. When I watched your appearance on the Greg Gutfeld show, I was embarrassed because I remember having watched a portion of the Sop to Hillary. This is when Greg played all these clips of comedy writers reading out these glowing thank you cards on The Tonight Show to Hillary Clinton as she sits there. These are comedy writers. They're people paid to write jokes. And instead, they're doing these Hallmark greeting cards with soppy piano music underneath, saying how much they love Hillary. And this guy, Lloyd Nixon, says, at first I thought this was a rather long joke, but I wasn't interested enough to wade through it to the punchline. And he goes, how far will this go over time, and does it affect the quality of their work product? There will be no jokes in the future. I've got a whole section of this in my book called Last Laughs. Because if you look at jokes now, jokes are actually about attitude. And the classic moment was what's it called? Stephen Colbert, guy who's taken over from David Letterman, The Late Show. And he comes on and he does a joke. He begins by saying that Trump has just fired Jim Comey. And everybody cheers because they think Jim Comey's the head of the FBI. So they think it's good that he's been fired. And then Stephen Colbert has to explain to them that that's not something they're meant to laugh at. It's meant to be a bad thing that Trump has fired Jim Comey. And so that's the point. It's nothing to do with jokes anymore. It's nothing to do with comedy. It's to do with the correct attitude. And that's why if you notice on a lot of those shows, you get that rather knowing applause. People don't find it funny anymore. But so they applaud themselves they applaud the joke because the joke has the correct attitude. So actually in an interesting sociological phenomenon, we're watching the joke evolve instead into a demonstration of a correct attitude, and that itself is actually quite a fascinating sociological phenomenon, which is my way of saying whatever that show was, The Tonight Show, all those comedy writers doing their thank you notes to Hillary, eventually, in essence, all these. And that's why, incidentally, they all backed off from doing jokes about Harvey Weinstein. They didn't know how to do it. You know, Saturday Night Live, the world's most cobwebbed and geriatric edgy comedy show, couldn't actually figure out, because Harvey Weinstein is supposed to be on the side of the angels, because he's a big Hillary donor, they couldn't actually figure out, well, where's the comedy in that? We can't make any, because they're striking attitudes. And as I always say, and I think I first said this after I happened to be in an elevator. I happened to be not in an elevator, actually a lobby, the elevator lobby, next to Strom Thurmond when he mistook me for a woman and started stroking my hand. You always have to be able to see the comedy in your own side. And once you lose that, there are very, very few laughs. Thank you for all your letters. We will see you next time.